the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and first this morning, Katie Mullally and I speak with math whiz Shalini Sharma, who reveals not only the dire need for math skills, but also the beauty and creativity of math in her new book, Math Mind, The Simple Path to Loving Math. Then astrobiologist and theoretical physicist Sarah Amari Walker is at the forefront in the quest to use physics to define life and to identify other forms of life in the universe. And she explores the physics of life's emergence. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, here is a startling figure. 80% of students who fail algebra drop out of high school. That's making numeracy, not literacy, one of the biggest predictors of getting into and graduating college. And yet, despite these dire consequences, we as a society continue to perpetuate the harmful myth that some people just aren't, quote unquote, math people. Well, our next guest will tell us differently. Shalini Sharma is the child of refugees and has always been passionate about universal access to an excellent education. She became a leading math learning expert and founded the nonprofit called Zurn, the top-rated math learning platform used by 1 in 4 elementary students and over 1 million middle school students nationwide. Now she's on a mission to prove that math is for everyone. And Shalini's new book is called Math Mind, The Simple Path to Loving Math. Shalini, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. So excited to be here.
So I'm just wondering, at what point in your life did you turn on to math? And was it the same point in time where you saw some of your classmates turning off of math?
Thank you for that question. Yes, that is what happened. So I was in sixth grade. I had just transferred to a new middle school, and I was really behind the other kids and really behind in math in particular. And, you know, I had essentially started to give up. My goal was just to survive the math class. But this lucky thing happened, which is my math teacher called me over to his desk. We had just taken a test and we were going through the test at his desk. And he said, "You did better on this test. If you try your best, you could be just as good as the boys." And he tipped his head over to the boys who were just thriving, you know, crushing that math class. And I know by maybe our 2024 perspective, that might seem to be an insensitive thing to say to a little girl. And there are still really serious gender issues in STEM, which we'd love to get into. But that sixth grade little girl, my heart just exploded with joy. And it changed my whole perspective, because this was the coolest teacher I had ever met, who I admired so deeply. And he took the time to tell me not that I could survive the class, but that I could be one of the best if I applied myself. And I really did. And in that year and the years that followed, I started to experience math in a different way. The experience of sort of everything falling into place, the aha moments, the deep just passion, power and beauty that math has intrinsically. And I moved beyond just trying to get good grades for him or my teachers or my parents, to really just seeing the beauty of math. But at the same time, in middle school, many of my friends gave up on math. And that's why I share that was lucky. And one thing I hope that we start to think about is, what if that wasn't lucky? What if we just believed all kids were math kids? What if every kid had that experience I did, where Mr. Snyder told me that I could thrive?
Exactly. Well, what a gift Mr. Snyder gave to you. But then there was something else in you that also launched into this place where you were no longer doing it for Mr. Schneider or for your parents or for whomever, you found the beauty in math. Before we get into creating all of us as math minds, I'd like to know where you think we have gone wrong in education, that we're not presenting, you know, that figure you gave about algebra, 80% of students who fail algebra drop out of high school, and so many people lose it at algebra. Are we just failing to make a connection to the real world with our math teaching?
Yeah. I mean, that's the right question to ask. And in our work building Zurn, we took a counterintuitive approach. And we found that we could get to better results when we really focused on what was working. And so there's actually a movement of educators across the country that we're a part of that are working to make math make sense, make math relevant, make math accessible. But it has to start by exploding some myths. Because actually, when we say the word math, we think, you know, we're saying the same thing, but what it might conjure for you and what it might conjure for me could actually be diametrically opposed, right? I'm talking about, you know, beauty and everything falling into place and the empowerment that no adult gets to tell me if I'm right or wrong, because I know I'm right. And others may be thinking about humiliation and drudgery and nothing making sense and memorizing things that don't make sense, right? And so we can use that same four-letter word, math, but we mean totally different things. And so we have to start by exploding these myths. And the first myth is what we started at the top, that there's the myth of the math kid. There's some whiz out there. You're born with it. Math ability is an inborn genetic trait. That's absolute nonsense. We know from science that babies as old as 2 weeks old can understand quantities. Pigeons can count, so can dolphins. So this is nonsense. There's no genetic ability here. We can all cultivate our math minds. But there's more pernicious myths in the day-to-day teaching of math. So one of them that I'll talk about is that math is about speed. Think about an elementary school, you know, calling out the answer as fast as you can. That's the kid who knows math. Everyone else should feel quiet and try to hide so nobody calls on them. You know, math presented as a running race where only one kid wins the running race. I mean, that's nonsense and that's silly. That's actually the opposite of math. Math is a slow, deliberate process to solve problems. You know, scientists are not shouting out the answer, you know, as fast as they can. That's not how it actually works in the real world. And so math is filled with these myths. Another one is that you have to memorize, that you don't get to understand. Well, you can understand. And, you know, I'll tell you that understanding is often easier than memorizing, but we present memorization. And that's not a class you're dying to get into. You know, you're waiting for the door to open to rush in to memorize something. And so that these are the myths that are sitting inside math teaching and learning that there are lots of educators trying to push out of math.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with author Shalini Sharma. She's just written the book, Math Mind, The Simple Path to Learning. Well, you brought up an interesting thing when we first started about people just assume, oh, you can do math or you can't do math. And we're so quick to label students, adults, anybody, but we don't really say, oh, well, she's just not a writer or she just can't read. Like, why is math, which seems to me, and I love math, I bumped up against it in some levels, but it should be as a fundamental skill as reading and writing, but yet we put it on this pedestal, if you will, where it's only certain people get to be able to do math. What happened there?
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. Imagine if we, you know, children went to elementary school, kindergarten through fifth grade, and we tested, we diagnosed kids, we found the reading kids. It was about 10% of kids. The rest we sorted into the non-reading pile, and we were totally content with them coming out of elementary school illiterate. I mean, it would be a scandal. It would be in the newspapers. If we found the memo, you know, there'd be a whistleblower report around it. Nobody would be okay with that. And so I'll say it differently, which is when children at a population level are not succeeding in reading, we all get mad at the adults. We say the adults have failed. when children at a population level in the United States, and I will say this is not happening in other countries, in the United States, when they're not successful in math, we say, well, let's not be mean to them because they're not math kids. They have other passions. And so in that kindness, we lower our expectations of what those children can do, and we seal their fate and we seal our fate.
Yeah.
You know, the why on this is deep. And I don't know that I can fully excavate the history and sociology of the why, but what I would say is that it comes from a mindset of scarcity, right? That we can't all succeed in math, so let's just find the few. It also comes from a mindset of sort of what you know, to cite Carol Dweck, a fixed mindset, that the only folks who can succeed are those who have inborn ability, and that there's no point for hard work and struggle in math. But anything worth doing in life, anything, has hard work as part of it. And so it takes hard work to build your math mind. By the way, it takes hard work to build your reading brain. You know, sit down and talk to a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds and they'll tell you how hard they are working to build their reading brain.
Yeah.
And so that's part of, you know, what we're, I think the opportunity here is so massive. And again, I would say that I think we're right at the precipice of changing our mind as a country on this. But the first is we do have to change our mind.
Well, Shalini, do you think that math has a PR problem? I've always wanted to write a book called In Defense of Algebra, because algebra, geometry, it's not just about the numbers. It's not just about the if-thens, where do you put the parentheses, if A equals B, then. It's also about learning how to think differently, how to solve problems, how to make correlations. So how do we fix math's PR problem?
I love it. Math does have a PR problem. I couldn't agree more. So I think there's a few dimensions to it, but the first one that comes to mind I want to share, which is, think of math as you think of it. If we say math, you know, your audience, you guys might be conjuring numbers and X's and Y's and symbols, right? So that might be coming through your brain. And think of that as the shorthand. It's a brilliant shorthand created by mathematicians. And that shorthand represents the real world we live in, because math is just the language of the real world we live in. And one reason that math has become less interesting, and honestly can feel like torture to children, is because all we do is make them memorize the shorthand without showing them any real understanding. So I'll give you a simple example. Third graders love proofs. They love deep understanding. And so, you know, we've done this extensively, working with third graders and having them prove that n times zero is zero. So any number times zero is zero. When I was a kid, I'm not sure if you experienced this, but when I was a kid, I just memorized that. And anytime I saw something times zero, I feel just a tad bit of, even today, just a touch of anxiety. Is it zero? Because I'd only memorized it. I'd never understood it. But actually, you can understand it, right? So if you think about it, we can think about it as plates and cookies. 3 times 2 is 6. So that's 3 plates. And on each plate, there are 2 cookies. And so you can imagine, you can conjure 6 cookies in your head. And then you can say, okay, well, 3 plates with 1 cookie on each plate, that's 3. Now, 3 plates with 0 cookies on each plate, well, that's very upsetting because that's 0 cookies. And how can you forget that? 8 plates with 0 cookies, that's still 0. 100 plates with 0 cookies. And so now you know axiomatically, you know the proof that n times 0 is 0. And when you traverse the world of math with these kinds of proofs and understanding, it is empowering. It's beautiful. You can trust it. And so I don't know that we can have a PR fix for math until math feels awesome. And there is that math, but we don't always show it to kids. We hide it.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Math Mind, The Simple Path to Loving Math is the book we're talking about. And our guest is Shalini Sharma, and she is here to make all of us feel that math is beautiful. And it's funny that you said, Shalini, that third graders love deep proof. proofs. Is it something about that age in particular, and when they lapse into fourth grade? Because I've always thought it's the fourth graders that are the ones that really, you know, love to explore learning. But can you talk to us a little bit? Because obviously you've done a lot of research into kids at every age.
Yeah. Look, you know, at CERN, we serve millions of students, and we have our app data. We're in classrooms every week. And I also am the mom of 13-year-old boys who are starting eighth grade. And what I would say, you know, just a humble observation of kind of witnessing children's learning, is I would say that children are so deeply curious about how the world works. And when we tell them as adults how the world works, they are delighted in their knowledge of the world. And then the only thing that you can add to that in middle school, as children move into adolescence, is in addition to that, they want to know that they matter, that they can be successful, right? And so these are the questions that are inside their minds. But that kind of deep intrinsic knowledge of how the world works is one of the deepest motivations children have. I've been to hundreds of classrooms on three continents observing math learning. And I'll tell you that there is a universal, consistent experience, which teachers, parents, you know, administrators, when they see that "I get it" moment in a child's face, you know, so a child's learning math and then all of a sudden it clicks and you can see a child's face actually light up and you can see them get it. That's what we're all actually trying to do in schools. We're trying to help children get it and feel honestly like a dopamine hit in their body. But the way to do that has to be, first, we have to believe that kids can get that. But the second is to show them the meaning in mathematics, not just ask them to memorize.
I was at a little gathering of adults the other night, and math was the topic that came up. And you heard the varying stories about why algebra just doesn't apply to life, and why and when and how people dropped math as something that they felt successful at all, and mostly felt a lot of failure at. My husband, for example, would be one of those people that said he was not a good student. And, you know, probably a lot of that surrounded something like algebra. And yet, that guy can do fast math in his head faster than anyone I know. I mean, calculating interest and return on investment and like square footage and all this stuff. And it all goes so quickly. And I go, wait a minute, there's such a disparity there. You know, this book a lot is looking at adults. It's not just looking at kids, it's looking at us as adults and kind of revamping the role of math in our lives. So give us a couple of those little nuggets from your book.
Yeah, I mean, I am asked to often defend algebra. So I love the idea of an algebra PR team. You know, the first I would say is that there has to be a reason that algebra is the greatest predictor of completing high school, getting into college, completing college, and increases lifetime earnings in any career. So there has to be a reason. Let's try to extrapolate what the reason could be. And what I would say is that algebra is the reasoning class. It's the logic class we all get to take. And who doesn't need to reason and logic and use logic to navigate problems in their lives? You know, algebra teaches us something basic, which is if we have a very complicated problem, we break it into small parts, we solve each small part, and then we put it back together again. That is one of your deepest life lessons, right? And so who doesn't need that in all aspects of their life? Now, I would come back to saying that, yes, math class for a lot of us was humiliating. It was a running race and we lost it every day. So that is not motivating. But what I would also say is that if we all agree that numeracy is as vital as literacy for the future for our children, then what are our options of what we want to share with our children? Option A, math is a rare genetic inborn ability and you don't have it. Okay, that seems terrible, so let's not go with that. Option B, math, you got to be good at math, otherwise you're going to fail. It's a terrible experience. Grit your teeth and just put your head down and do it. And if it doesn't feel good, whatever. Life doesn't feel good. Okay, that's not a great message either. That's not going to last. And so what about a third message, which I would offer all adults, which is, as your children explore math, and as children you know and love explore math, what if you gave it a second chance? What if you explored it as well? It is a thing of beauty. And so what if you actually went through the experience of understanding, not memorizing, of realizing that it's not a running race that you lose every single day, that that's absolutely silly. And one more, which we didn't talk about, which is this idea that math is super creative. Now, there's only one, let's say we were going to add together 13 and 37. Now, we might have been taught a single way to solve it. Stack the numbers and follow an algorithm. Carry the one. What if we said, actually, the answer is 50, and there's only one correct answer in math, and that's part of its beauty. But there are a dozen ways to get to 50, and each way is so interesting. And actually, I love to hear your way. In my way, you know, I'm adding 30 plus 10 plus 7 plus 3. Another person might see the 7 and 3, automatically know it's a 10, and say 30 plus 10 plus 10. And each of these ways is super interesting. And so we bring what is in mathematics, which is creativity. And so I think where I would end is, it would be really great if we could all give math a second chance and dare to love it.
Well, I think we all need to put the calculator down every once in a while and be like Lynn's husband, Bob, and figure it out in our heads, because it really is, it's a good mental exercise to add the checkbook or whatever it is I need to add up. Well, in the book, you talk about, and this is really important, about how we can move forward after the pandemic, because math really needs to be something that I feel like it's an in-person learning experience. And the pandemic wiped out, you say, 20 years of math learning progress. What needs to be done to catch back up or even go beyond that?
Yeah. It's such a good question. And, you know, I'd say the pandemic wiped out 20 years of progress, but also revealed how far behind lots of students were in mathematics. So it sort of was a double-edged sword. I think that one of the things we have is this idea that if you fall behind in math, it is a signal that you don't have the rare genetic inborn material. And so you are not a math kid. You know, in anything we learn, it doesn't matter, you pick it, anything you're learning, you will have moments where you fall behind. And when you do, in all the other parts of life, it's a signal to work harder. And so what I'd say is that we are now at a place where lots of kids are behind in mathematics, and we have an opportunity for them to catch up. And the most important thing as students catch up is that we can't immediately move into a remedial track where students are now, let's say we have a rising eighth grader like my children, and the pandemic learning that was disrupted was really third, fourth, fifth grade in that time period. And so their knowledge of decimals and decimal division is a little shaky. So it is not practical for an eighth grader who's doing pre-algebra to spend weeks and months doing decimal division. And so we have to find fast ways to catch these kids up while they still get to learn their eighth grade material. You know, I'll give you a simple example, which we have in the Zurn app. When students are struggling with decimal division. So there's one problem, which is when students in seventh grade see 1.4 divided by 2, we see post-pandemic children struggling with that question. And one option would be to put them into weeks of decimal, you know, refresh, decimal division refresh. But here's what we find. When we simply ask them, what is 14 divided by 2? All of them answer 7. And then we put the problem, 1.4 divided by 2, back in front of them again. The vast majority answer 0.7. Because what we have to remember as we catch kids up is that math is only a few big ideas. And there are very efficient ways to catch kids up and keep them going on grade level.
Well, back to Lynn's comment about how we can all embrace math more as adults. What can we do through our daily lives, short of, you know, when you know, 13 plus 37, we all had our own ways of thinking of that. But in addition to paying attention to how we add, how else can we as adults incorporate or appreciate math more as we go about our daily life?
Yeah, I love that question. You know, One thing we learned during the pandemic is that children didn't want their parents to be their math teachers, and vice versa. Parents didn't want to be their kids' math teachers. So, so I think that we can bring math into our daily lives in a way that's fun. So let's take the what we know as the public health messaging around reading. Read to your child something they enjoy for 20 minutes a day. The corollary in math would be play games, board games, card games, games in the real world for 20 minutes a day. Games are full of mathematics and you don't even know it. I'll give you an example. One of our family favorite games as my kids were growing up, Battleship. It seems like a game that's about sinking each other's ships. It's actually a lesson in the coordinate plane. You get a hit on E5, you know the next one you're calling out, E6. And we don't have to pause and do a whole lesson. You know, no different than if you were reading to your child, you wouldn't say, now, please tell me what the subject, verb, and object of that sentence would be. That would really ruin the story. So don't ruin the story. Just play the games and know that there is so much math in all of our favorite games.
What a great example, Shalini. And for all our listeners out there who are identifying with this, who love games, you too can be a math mind. So Shalini Sharma is our guest, and her book is Math Mind, The Simple Path to Loving Math. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, one of the biggest and deepest questions is, what is life? And it's really more than an existential question, as our next guest, astrobiologist and theoretical physicist, Sarah Imari Walker, will tell us. Sarah is at the forefront in the quest to use physics to define life and identify other forms of life in the universe. She's a deputy director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science and a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. She's written a new book, Life as No One Knows It, The Physics of Life's Emergence. And she joins us today. Sarah Walker, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you to explore such a deep question. But I'm first curious about you. You're young, you're bleeding edge, brilliant science mind. What is your background?
Yeah, so actually, I didn't really know I wanted to be a scientist till I went to community college. So both my parents have more of an artistic background. My dad's a hairstylist and my mom is an antique dealer. So most of my childhood memories are like, you know, being carted around Connecticut where I grew up to go to different antique stores and shoving antiques in the car. So it was a very different sort of, it wasn't very enriched in, I mean, we did a lot of science, but it wasn't like, you know, a main focus of my childhood and certainly not the academic lifestyle. But when I went to community college, I absolutely fell in love with physics. I just thought it was the most fabulous subject. And I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
So here you are. And then was it theoretical physics that made you start questioning what life is? And what does that question look like for you?
Yeah, so the reason I loved physics so much and I still love physics is because I think it's a way of asking really deep and fundamental questions about the nature of reality. And I just love that as humans that we're capable of thinking at that level of abstraction and actually coming up with things that we can test. And so traditionally, thinking about life hasn't really been, you know, one of the main areas of physics, in part because life is so hard from a physicist's perspective, because it's really hard to find those deep universal principles. And so what really got me excited about thinking about life, it wasn't really until I was a PhD student, and I had already set down on the path of like cosmology and particle physics, thinking those are the most fundamental things to study, that I really realized that the origin of life question was kind of a new frontier for physics because we didn't know the answers. And in fact, there weren't a lot of really strong theoretical proposals for what the nature of the transition from non-living to living things could even be. And I thought that was exciting. That to me seems like you want to work on frontier problems and make big contributions, you should probably work on the really hard ones. So that's what I decided to do. It's a little crazy, but I really love the problem. It's really fun.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Sarah Amari Walker. She is the Deputy Director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, and author of the new book, Life as No One Knows It, The Physics of Life's Emergence. Well, I will never forget watching Cosmos, the first one, years and years ago, where Carl Sagan had the tank of water and he added all of the ingredients that you would find in the human body, but nothing crawled out.
Yeah.
So what is the difference? What is that delineation between, say, a tank full of ingredients and an actual life form? They both have the same components.
Yeah. I mean, this is the big question. You know, one of my favorite other videos is Julia Child cooking the primordial soup, right? And she mixes all the ingredients like it's a cooking recipe and you're going to get life out of it. But of course, no life came out of the primordial soup experiments yet either. I think the issue is that we don't really understand the process of evolution before things like cells. And so certainly it had to be the case that evolution and selection could operate from the earliest stages of chemistry to actually even evolve something as complex as a living thing. So most of the physics that I'm really interested in is trying to build a deeper understanding of what the process of evolution and selection is and how it actually constructs things like us before there are cellular architectures that are already capable of evolution. And I think that's really where the deep mystery is how do you go from like simple chemistry to a complex cell? And we don't really actually understand how to bridge that gap.
Well, most people would assume that this work, and especially how you're pushing the boundaries of the previous ideas, would be done by a chemist or a biologist. You're astronomy, you're a physicist, you're an astrobiologist. How does physics fit into this, the development of these new equations and new theories?
Yeah, so I work with a lot of collaborators from those other disciplines. So I just want to say that like it's a very highly collaborative effort. And one of the things that's really hard is that the problem of what life is doesn't fit squarely in any current discipline. It's like, you know, it's post-paradigm in some sense. It's a new frontier for science. I think one of the reasons that I'm really excited about the problem with my training in theoretical physics is that I'm really interested in universal laws. And these are really important for astrobiology in particular, because we don't want to just understand life as it exists on Earth. We want to understand life anywhere in the universe. And it could be radically different in terms of its chemistry in a different planetary environment. And also, you know, we know biology on Earth and biologists have studied biological forms on Earth, but we don't know what alien life forms are going to look like. They could be so radically different, we might not even call them biology. So I think really having kind of a more cosmic perspective on the problem in a more deeper universal way of trying to ask questions about the nature of life is really fundamental to astrobiology as a discipline, because we're not just thinking about life here, we're thinking about alien life. And the origin of life, you know, you didn't have biology yet, so, but it's when chemistry transitions into biology. So it seems to, you know, suggest that you need something a little bit deeper to try to unify them.
Yeah. Well, speaking of interdisciplinary sort of work, I think one of your greatest collaborators is a chemist. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the connection when we talk about what is life between chemistry and theoretical physics?
Yeah. So, my collaborator, Lee Cronin, is formerly trained as a chemist and I'm formerly trained as a cosmologist. So it's kind of an interesting collaboration to have two people working on the origin of life in such a sort of interesting way. And a lot of our ideas end up being pretty provocative because they're coming from really different disciplinary perspectives. But I think we share a motivation that we really want to solve the problem. And, you know, from my perspective, I think the interesting thing is theoretical physics right now kind of stops at the scale. You know, we have, you know, the standard model of particle physics, we have the periodic table of the elements, and then the chemistry takes over at the periodic table of the elements. And there's lots of places where physics informs chemistry, like quantum chemistry and these kind of things. But there's not like a broad explanatory paradigm of the nature of how complexity arises out of chemistry and how that, you know, transitions into living things. And so to think that there might be a new frontier for theoretical physics that emerges you know, where molecules start to interact and construct more complex structures, I think is, to me, incredibly exciting. And that's really the frontier that we're asking questions about with the origins of life. So it feels very natural to have the chemistry and the theoretical physics merge together to build some new ideas about the process of evolution just in chemical systems before you even have living things. And so, yeah, it seems natural, but maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that sounds natural. And it's really interesting. It's really fascinating. I'm wondering, you know, with the question of what is life, do you find the additional questions of alien life and artificial intelligence, you know, both equally something that you've got to just figure out? Or, you know, how does it all relate with alien life and AI?
So the question of origins of life and thinking about the nature of life sort of more universally leads you to a much broader concept of what life is. So my conception of life is life is about lineages of information and how it structures you know, complex objects. And those complex objects could be anything from me as a living thing to artifacts that life produces, like computers or cell phones. Like, those don't occur outside of a living process, a process of evolution, making things on a planet over billions of years. And so, so I'm really interested in this idea of life as this sort of continuity between different forms, and that information is sort of the thread that connects them. And this leads naturally to thinking about modern technology as an example of life. But you might want to make a distinction between things that are alive and creative like we are and things that are artifacts of life, or things that, you know, were necessary for an evolutionary process over billions of years to make those things possible, but they wouldn't exist on a planet that didn't have life. So technology kind of has a natural framing in the way that I'm thinking about things, but also alien life, because alien life would be a lineage that emerged on a different planet and underwent the same sort of process of an open-ended evolutionary process of you know, making things that couldn't exist in the absence of a living system. Like, that's kind of the main thesis of our argument, is that some things are so complex they don't happen outside of life. And actually most structures the universe could build, because it's like exponentially large number of things the universe could actually make once you get to chemistry. Most of them are only possible to exist as part of a living process. And that's, to me, pretty mind-blowing and really unifying between thinking about what alien life is, what technology is, what the deep history of our planet is. And those are the kind of things that physicists are really good at, is taking things that seem really different and trying to find a really common underlying description that might seem quite abstract. We love doing that, but it ends up giving us very powerful explanatory paradigms that allow us to see things that we wouldn't be able to really understand and recognize otherwise. And that's what we need to do with alien life.
Well, Sarah, speaking of paradigms, one of the main points of your book is you talk about assembly theory. Mm-hmm. Where life basically forms through evolution. And it's not just the evolution that we're thinking of, Darwin's theory of evolution. This is a whole other definition, if you will. Explain to us, in the short time frame that we have, the basis of your assembly theory.
Yeah, so I think I've already alluded to this idea that we need something before the origin of cells, right, to explain the origin of cells. So it already suggests the origin of life problem, that there needs to be something that's kind of a little bit deeper than our current evolutionary paradigms, which work brilliantly once you have biological forms, but they don't extend beyond that. And I think, you know, from the perspective of assembly theory, we think that selection is a fundamental process in nature, and it occurs pretty much everywhere. But the place that you start to see it becoming really important is in chemistry, because the space of possible molecules that could exist on a planet is astronomically large. So, you know, I'm being trained in physics. I'm used to thinking like the Hubble Deep Field and looking at, like, you know, the tens of thousands of galaxies, and aren't we tiny? The universe is so big. But we don't like think about the, you know, billions and billions and billions of possible molecules that are just, you know, like a few atoms stuck together that we could possibly synthesize on our planet. Like, there's just, it's a huge space. And the key conjecture of assembly theory is there's actually like a complexity threshold if you're looking at the space of possible molecules above which you require selection and evolution in order to produce those complex objects. And we have a way of formalizing that, talking about a measure that we can actually measure of molecules, about how many steps to form a molecule is actually this sort of evolutionary bound, and have experimental evidence to suggest that living things are the only structures that actually can produce complex objects. So that's sort of the foundation of it, but it leads to some really radical reframings of some really basic concepts in physics. And the one that I'm most excited about is to think about evolved objects actually having a size and time, because you actually have to talk about their construction history as a physical property. And that's really radical as a physicist, but I find it really interesting because most theories of physics have reinvented concepts of time. And so I find these kind of new philosophies that emerge out of just doing like really basic science really exhilarating from a theoretical perspective, because it really means that you're building something that's a really different understanding of nature.
What you talk about in the book about how we really won't understand or can't fully grasp what it takes to create life until we create it ourselves. Mm-hmm. But to me, that seems kind of scary, because what happens if we create something that doesn't necessarily, well, AI might be a good example of this. It isn't necessarily good for humans.
Yeah, so I am incredibly excited about the experimental prospect of like evolving alien life in the lab, which is really like, you know, the process of just making a chemical system in the lab without putting a prior design in, and like seeing de novo emergence of some chemical system that we might call living. Like that's the goal of like all of this, right? And the reason that's a goal is because it would be validation of the sort of explanatory framework that we have for the origin of life. The reason I think that's important is exactly because of the sort of scare issue that you have right now, right? So I think we're building a lot of things without really understanding fundamental principles. And that scares me more than actually understanding. I mean, the science is a brilliant human enterprise, because it gives us new ways of understanding the world. And when you understand the world, you can anticipate how things will behave, and you can actually, you know, plan. And right now we're building a lot of artificial intelligence technologies. People are trying to make artificial life in the lab without any kind of solid foundation about what these things are existentially, or, you know, like in the physical world, as, you know, really, like, are they living systems or not? Are they intelligent systems or not? So I think going back to first principles and asking these really basic science questions is actually critical for the next phase of our own technology, because we're otherwise going to be building things that we don't understand.
So when you go back to those most basic science questions, are there things that might surprise us that don't, that we think of as evolved objects, mm-hmm. with size and time, that you're sort of finding through your theories that aren't?
Yeah, that's a great question. So usually I'm thinking this sort of the other way, that there's, mm-hmm. lots of things that, we typically don't think of as necessarily being products of evolution, that are. And so my conception of life is pretty much everything on this planet is a manifestation of the physics underlying life, because everything on this planet has a history in the objects and sort of a necessary past sequence of events necessary to make those kind of structures. I think it would be hard for me to think of examples where we think it's evolved, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I'm straining to like try to come up with a clever one.
Well,
it's
okay.
Such
while
a good
you,
question.
Yeah. While you think about that, let's talk about, as you said, you take it the opposite way.
Yeah.
We've already talked about possible, you know, AI as being one of those things that is an evolved object that we don't, mm-hmm. think of as, or we think of, you know, the possibility of alien life. And then the other things pop up for me are things like the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, what else in, you know, within,
yeah.
that, and then maybe that will jog kind of your creativity into thinking of things the opposite way.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, the internet, I also think is, you know, life, right? So I did try to make a distinction between what I think is life and alive, which I also talk about in the book. So life is anything that requires evolution to necessitate its existence. So I don't think that, you know, any complex configuration of matter, whether it's the internet, or an AI or you or me can spontaneously form in the universe outside of this kind of causal history of these processes that happen on a planet over billions of years to make things like us. So that's sort of a key conjecture of assembly theory, is that you have to have the history in order for these objects to exist. And so I think that qualifies pretty much everything, but the counterexamples would be probably things that are a little bit more traditional for astrobiologists to want to think about as biosignatures. So I really respect, but I also disagree with a lot of my peers that are interested in looking for, simple atmospheric gases like phosphine or oxygen or methane in exoplanet atmospheres. Cause to me, those are not signatures of life. Those are atmospheric gases that could be produced by a metabolism, but they could also be produced abiotically, and they're not definitive. And so there's this idea in the field of astrobiology about false positives, like there will be always be things that mimic the biological signal. So we have to build context and try to tease out, is it life or is it not? And I am, after the developments of assembly theory and how we came up with this complexity measure that we could actually go and validate in the lab, and we're able to show that there are some, molecules can be definitive biosignatures if they're complex enough. Like, those are not subject to false positives if the theory holds and we continue on the track that we're on. And I think to me, that's a better way of qualifying what life is, because you don't have any case that could not be life. It's just either it is or it isn't. And as far as the things that are definitive, it doesn't mean that living processes can't happen for low complexity objects. So you can have a situation where those like phosphine can be produced by life, but you couldn't definitively say it had to, because its existence is predicated on the fact that life has to exist in order to make it. And that's the key distinction that we're trying to draw, is that there are many things on this planet in particular, pretty much everything is necessitated by having this history and information built up in these objects for all of the structures on this planet to exist. They can't just spontaneously happen. They have to have that structure and that history.
So Sarah, this sounds like you're really bringing in the component of physics into mm-hmm. life. I mean, life has always been based around biology or chemistry, and now you're proposing that life is also or is based around physics. What kind of pushback, if any, are you getting from the other traditional areas of biology and chemistry?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the sort of pushback is typically like the interesting ones. There's some that are sort of, people just have their dogmas and don't want to like engage with new ideas. But I think there is kind of a sense that life doesn't represent a new frontier in physics. And so when I'm saying that I think life does represent a new frontier in physics, it's not like we can take current theories of physics and apply them to life. It's not like thermodynamics is the explanation for life. It's not like, quantum physics is the explanation for life. It's like there is actually something fundamentally going on in living systems that we haven't understood yet that represents some very deep structure about the nature of the reality that we live in. So it's a theory that, is necessarily as deep as quantum mechanics or general relativity and its explanatory power and its universality. But it's something that you only see the structure of when you're looking at living things. So I kind of think of the way that we're talking about assembly theory as like building the space-time in which evolution acts, and talking about the physical structure of evolutionary objects in the same sense that, you had to build space-time for gravity, and then you have mass defines the structure of how objects move in space-time, right? So it's kind of a loose analogy, but that's really how we're thinking about, constructing a new physics for this domain. And I think, the main challenge there is, as I said, whether you believe that there's additional explanation necessary or not, and the place where that really confronts you. So, but for biologists, I think they're, they're like, oh, well, we have evolutionary theories that work perfectly fine. We don't need this new set of ideas, but we have not solved the origin of life with current theories. And so, the only thing I can point to is there are these unsolved problems, like how do we unambiguously detect life on another planet, or how do we actually quantify the transition from non-life to life so that we can experimentally test it in the lab, that current theories can't solve. And if we can solve those problems with a new idea, then it suggests to me that that new idea is telling us something different and exciting.
Well, I've always been fascinated with that idea of the transition from non-life to life. I remember reading a book years ago when Schumacher was talking about, we have rocks and then we have plants, and then we have animals, and we have humans. And he was proposing these clear delineations, but especially between rocks and plants, they're a lot of the same chemicals. How close are you getting to what caused that transition? Because it really is a massive delineation between life and non-life.
Yeah. So this is the thing I'm most excited about, because I've been waiting my whole career to be able to say what that transition is. So I think we're getting a lot closer. I'm incredibly optimistic at this stage, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book, because I wanted to share sort of the frontier of how we're thinking about things and really get people excited about, you know, the deeper questions that these kind of problems afford. Like, you know, we're always kind of like, is physics dead? Is physics not dead? And it's like, well, physics is moving to this like new space of life and mind. And there's incredibly exciting questions to ask there that are really quite deep theoretically. So, on the question of the origin of life itself, I think assembly theory gives us right now empirically something we can measure in the lab about when a system can be said to have, you know, crossed the boundary between non-life and life. So we have a measure that tells us that that's happened. And now we're trying to use the structure of that theory to basically talk about how a system can transition from one phase to the other. So from, you know, a very low complexity and never, you know, generates all of these sort of inaccessible structures that are, you know, require information, to one that actually has had enough selection to be able to construct objects that are very complex. And that transition, I think, you know, we're pretty close to being able to formalize it. It's almost like a phase transition for people that like physics, you know, like from, you know, like wet to, you know, like water evaporates, right? And there's two different phases. It's like, you imagine a living phase of a cascade of increasingly assembled objects and things getting deeper in time versus one where you have objects that don't really require memory for their formation and they can just, you know, kind of randomly explore the space of possibilities. That's the transition that we're talking about. And I am pretty sure that we are close to formalizing what that transition looks like. I have a lot of math that we've been doing and it looks very exciting, but it's not quite there yet because you have to be able to measure it. And that's always the hard part, is actually tying your abstractions to experiments. This is like the key thing I've learned in my career, is it's easy to be a theorist if you don't care about experiments. If you want to care about experiments, it's really hard, but you learn way more exciting things. So that's the part that we're trying to iterate on. And I'm working a lot with Lee Cronin, as I already mentioned, on that.
Yeah.
And other collaborators.
This is kind of mind-blowing and just fascinating at the same time. Before we let you go, Sarah, I just have to ask this question, and I'm sure it's one you've considered. But, you know, as you're confronting, you know, biologists and things like that, at the same time you were talking through it, I was sort of picturing religious scholars kind of like rubbing their hands together and saying, oh, this is where science and religion can intersect. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. So I always find it interesting that, you know, so many people think that religion and science are in conflict, because I never really saw like a really strong conflict between them. So I'm always interested in just sort of ideas that further human understanding. And, you know, many of those for many people are spiritual ideas, and for many people, they're scientific ideas. And I think both sort of domains of human inquiry are really trying to just understand how it all works and how we all got here and what it all means. So I'm incredibly excited about our ideas contributing to that dialogue and maybe, you know, helping further our understanding of what it is to be life just broadly across human culture. Because I think it's incredibly exciting. And I think the narratives that science has given so far are kind of, you know, they're kind of demeaning in some sense, like, you know, this idea that like all the fundamental stuff is in particles and fields and like, you know, we're just kind of some emergent epiphenomena. We have no meaning in the universe has kind of always been sort of a weird narrative to me, even as a physicist. So I think, you know, putting back agency and things about life really being fundamental to the structure of reality is incredibly empowering. And I'm really excited about that prospect and how we think about ourselves in the universe and what that means for lots of people and how they want to contribute to the dialogue of how we understand it.
Mm. Well, the book is Life as No One Knows It. And our guest has been Sarah Imari Walker. She is a theoretical physicist, a professor at Arizona State University, among many other things. Sarah, it's been a real pleasure having you join us here on Cool Science Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun.